In June, there was an extraordinary moment when a man tried to abduct a teenager from a Florida supermarket. It was caught on closed-circuit TV, showing the failed kidnapper dragging the stunned girl through the store aisles before her mother fought him off. That's how ballsy these people are. The 13-year-old was accompanying her mother on a mid-week grocery run at a Dollar General store near Citrus Hills in Hernando, Florida. But the Tuesday trip turned into the stuff of nightmares when a man suddenly approached the pair and tried to wrench the child away in an active grocery store. If that's not enough for you, on July 6th, in Victorville, California, an incident again caught on camera. A Southern California man was arrested on suspicion of trying to abduct a girl at an electronics store, CBS Los Angeles reported. Security video showing a young mother walking into the store in Victorville around 2:30 p.m. on July 1st. The woman was holding her baby while her 4-year-old daughter played with a candy machine by the door, merely feet behind her, merely feet. The store's owner said the woman told him she had noticed a strange man in the parking lot. She had said that the guy was looking at her from when she got out of her car, but she didn't think he would follow her, Miguel Macias told CBS Los Angeles News. But he did, and the video is chilling. You see the door swing open. This man reaches into the doorway and drags this 4-year-old girl out and tries to make a run. The quick-thinking mother ran out and was able to immediately stop this and immediately stop this abduction. This is taking place all around us. And it's not just kids biking on their own. It's a dangerous world. It's terrifying. 800,000 children are reported missing every year. Of that, around 155 of them are falling into this category of stranger abduction. Tonight, when I was placing postings on social media talking about the importance of tonight's show, and I posted on my Facebook pages, and I jumped over to Twitter and posted on Twitter and then checked my news feed, there, posted on my news feed, retweeted from a follower, a photograph of what appeared to be a naked 11-year-old girl on Twitter. That's how confident and ballsy these perpetrators are. I immediately called the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, alerted them to it, gave them the account name, and I photographed the names of people that retweeted the account and helped to spread this. I also contacted the local FBI department because that's what it tells you to do. Contact your local FBI agency and let them know about this. And they took a message and all the information down as well. You have to be proactive. Don't idly stand by. Don't be afraid to get involved because you don't want to get your hands messy. These are children, exploited children, naked 11-year-old girl being exploited on Twitter, of all things. We have to make the difference. It's up to us to reach out, make a difference, make the call. If you see a child that you feel is under duress and could possibly be trafficking, and wait till you hear about this as we progress in this show. It will astound you because you'll think that some of these children, they must be kept in basements or hidden in garages or crawl spaces, and that's not necessarily the way it goes down. Some of these people, some of these kids that have been stolen or are being sex trafficked are attending schools in different areas under new names. And they're not running away. It's heartbreaking to find out why. We'll continue that as we discuss this evening the case of Who Took Johnny, which is a documentary. It's an examination into an infamous 30-year-old cold case, the disappearance of Iowa paperboy Johnny Gosch. Our guests this evening are the documentarians of that film, David Bailenson and Michael Galinsky, also on the line with us this evening, the mother of Johnny Gosch, one of the first couple of boys to ever appear on the side of a milk carton. Noreen Gosch is with us this evening. We're going to continue this story, and there are so many other twists coming. You need to stay a part of this. Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way with our guests right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am your host this evening, Dave Schrader. And this evening we're discussing the disappearance of Johnny Gosch in 1982. He went missing, a paper boy, good kid, good member of the community, good heart, no reason to expect that he would run away. But yet that is exactly how the law enforcement, the FBI, treated this case. As we discussed, not only did he go missing, but 2 years later, almost to the date, another paper boy, Eugene Martin, disappears in the same fashion. Still missing, presumed dead. Now, in 1984, our guest, Noreen Gosch, had an important hand in two really big things. Noreen, tell us a little bit about the Johnny Gosch bill.
Well, I wrote the Johnny Gosch bill to ensure that every child that would end up missing at some point in time would receive an immediate investigation. And the first year, the bill went through the funnel and didn't get passed. The second year that we proposed it, it did pass. And in July of 1984, Governor Branstad signed it into law. And so the following month in August, the Martin family were the first to be able to use the Johnny Gosch bill because it ensured that their son would get an immediate investigation.
Noreen, I'm sorry, we're losing your audio a little bit. It sounds like you're getting further away. I don't know if you need to reposition the phone.
The bill ensured, once it was passed into law, that any child that would be missing would get an immediate investigation. And the Martin family were the first to use it because their boy was taken early in August and the bill was just signed into law in July of 1984, the month before.
And how quickly would this now put law enforcement onto a case like this?
Well, they wouldn't be able to delay anything up to 72 hours like they had choices to do in the past. It was ensuring that they would be on it within a few hours. And it was important to have that because this was the second kidnapping with Martin, and that meant Iowa had a kidnapping problem. And
with that said, if you don't mind me asking real quickly, David or Michael, if one of you wanted to weigh in on this, when you start to realize, okay, Johnny goes missing, Eugene goes missing, did you take a look going back a year or two or three to see if there had been another trend in that area of another child missing that may kind of fit into this sudden scope of what's going on with missing children in that area?
Yeah, we investigated it. And, you know, it was hard to find a connection to something. You know, there were cases of kids that had gone missing in the Midwest. Prior to that, there were cases of serial killers. There were cases of sort of random abductions. But it was hard to put a connection on anything. You know, it was hard to connect it all. Just using, you know, archival newspapers and sort of whatever archival news material that was out there.
Now talk to me about your work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Noreen. You worked along with John Walsh from the Adam Walsh case and most known from America's Most Wanted. How did that come together?
I was asked to speak before the Justice Department along with a number of other parents. And we were instructed to tell about our story, our son, our child's case, and to speak to what went right and what went wrong on the case, and to name names. And I was one of the last speakers of the day. There was a bit about 30, 40 ahead of me. And each family heart-wrenchingly told the same story, how they were told by the FBI, we don't have a case, your child has to, you have to prove that your child's in danger. It was a similar story with each one. So when I got up to speak, I said in my closing remarks, if the FBI is not going to search for our children. And it is clearly in their job description, because kidnapping is a federal crime. Then I suggest that the Justice Department cut their funding by a percentage and give that amount to another agency who will be there to help us. And you could have heard a pin drop in that place. Several people ran over to me and said, "Do you know where you're at? You just suggested cutting the funding to the FBI." And I said, "Yes, I know where I'm at. And I've had to pay for my investigation. I've had to pay and take extra jobs and work to pay detectives, because the law enforcement of which we pay taxes to would not. I'm within my rights to make a suggestion." Well, we got the first $10 million for the Missing Children's Center. And the head of the Missing Children's Center, the last time I talked to him, he said, "Noreen, they're still talking about your speech." And if it hadn't been for some of the remarks you made, I don't think we would have got the first $10 million that day.
Amazing
and
work.
And I got to a point that, you know, what if it was one of your children? And I, you know, put that out there to the decision makers. I said, "What if it was one of your children? Would you be satisfied with the answer?" "Well, you'll have to prove your child's in danger, and basically we have no crime. Would you settle for that?" And I just turned around and turned it back on them as parents. What would you do? Would you hire private investigators? Work your socks off to pay for it? You know, suddenly people could start to identify with all the parents that were there that were told that type of news. You have nowhere else to turn when your law enforcement agencies, one is saying the child's a runaway, the other is saying they won't enter the case because you have to prove the child's in danger. Then just how do you go about proving that to an agency?
Exactly. There, this isn't the only time that you worked with John Walsh in America's Most Wanted. We'll talk about that again in a little bit, because that's an important part of the story. Remember, if you're interested in the documentary, Who Took Johnny, you can find it on Amazon.com, where you can rent it or purchase it for download and watch. Or you can find it on iTunes as well. It will be available in a few weeks on Netflix, so that it is available for you to watch in its entirety. And give us the name of the book that you wrote again, Noreen, so that people can find it and find it on Amazon.
The name of the book is called Why Johnny Can't Come Home. And I have a website. It's www.johnnygosh.com.
All right. We'll make sure that we have links up
on the website.
Great. We'll have links up to that as well. Suddenly, there is a very dramatic thing that occurs in 1985 with a $1 bill. Noreen, talk to me about this and how this impacted you.
Yes, we received a dollar bill from a lady who got it in change at a grocery store. And it was on there, "I'm still alive, I am alive, Johnny Gosh." And the handwriting was compared to samples of Johnny's schoolwork and greeting cards that he had signed. And we even consulted a handwriting expert. We then worked with the Treasury Department, and they were able to give us information on the travel area of the dollar bill. Well, I never knew they scoped that out. But when bills are released for circulation, they generally travel in a specific area. Now, that may be somewhat altered now because people are so much more mobile, travel a lot more, so that area might be expanded.
Right.
But that helped us narrow down perhaps where they were with Johnny at the time.
Now, your son, at this point,
they determined it was his signature.
Your son has been missing for 4 years at this point, 3-4 years, correct?
Yes.
Had you, up to that time, up to that bill, had you started to believe that possibly your son was lost, that he was gone and had passed away at this point?
I have never given up that there would be an answer on the case, that there would be some resolution as to what happened to Johnny. If by some fortunate luck he was still alive, that would be our divine bonus. And many of the kids that are taken, they don't all perish and die, the ones that are put into the sex trade. Instead, they are more or less dumped when they are no longer of use. Because once you're no longer a 12-year-old boy that pedophiles would want, then the kidnappers have no use for you unless they turn you into one of them and have you work for them. And that happens with some in the more organized pedophilia, which is now known as human trafficking. Back in the day, they hadn't given it the name human trafficking as yet.
Right. And we'll get deeper into that as the story unfolds for us. So now you've got a $1 bill with your son's signature saying that he's alive. It has to reinstill a new fire in you and kind of encourage you to keep pushing forward. 1986 rolls in, and now there's a disappearance of another young man, Mark Allen. What can you tell us about that case?
Well, unbeknownst to everyone in our city, a young boy by the name of Mark Allen was taken off the street. He was listed as kidnapped. Fast forward a number of years, like two decades, and I got a call from the National Center for Missing Children saying, did you know that you have a third boy kidnapped in your city? I said, what? They overnighted Mark's file to me, and sure enough, a third boy had been kidnapped. As soon as I got the package of information, I contacted one of our well-known radio personalities and asked if I could come on his show. And he said, is there news on Johnny? And I said, no, but you're not going to believe what I have to show you. So I went there with my file. He looked it over before the show went on. And for 3 hours, we talked about Mark Allen, Eugene Martin, and Johnny Gosch, and what connections there might possibly be. Then communication was established with Mark's mother. And Mark's mother told me that when her boy was taken, the Des Moines police came to her home. They told her not to talk to the media, not to talk to anyone, and for God's sake, don't call Noreen Gosch. She's nothing but a troublemaker. If word leaks out that there's a third kidnapping, it will panic the city. That was from the police themselves to that mother. Now, with what went on in Johnny's case, Eugene Martin's case, and now Mark Allen, one would start to see the red flags flying high as to perhaps a cover-up for some reason. Why was this being suppressed? Why was that mother bullied into not speaking to anyone?
Those are excellent questions. We'll talk about them more. We have to take a break. And speaking of break, in 1991, a break in the case opens up from a very unlikely source. And you will need to hear this angle of the story because, again, no one could script this if it was a Hollywood movie and come up with something as bizarre as the story of Paul Bonacci. We'll do that when we return. Remember, check it out for yourself at thelassieproject.com, LassieProject.com. Because when it comes to a missing person, every second counts. Become part of a community and register your children and register yourself in the community so that you can be on alert and help out in a neighborhood where children may go missing. You can find out more information about that very important project at LassieProject.com. We'll be back. We've got so much more to discuss. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for the big man himself this evening, George Norrie. Thank you for letting me do this show this evening, George. Remember, if you'd like to see George live, George Norrie and Friends Living It Up in Asheville, North Carolina on August 27th. You can find more information about his amazing program that he'll be doing live along with ufologist Micah Hanks, the Paul Revere of our century, William Fortune, and paranormal investigator extraordinaire Joshua P. Warren. You can find information on seeing George and this extraordinary panel by going to coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. BeyondBelief.com. Familiarize yourself there, and you might find some other interesting information as well as BeyondBelief.com, George Norrie's TV show. So if you like what you hear and witness on Coast to Coast AM, make sure to check out BeyondBelief.com for even more content and deeper information with George Norrie. Our guests this evening are talking about the documentary and the real-life true crime of What Happened to Johnny Gosch. Our guests are David Bailenson, Michael Galinsky, and Johnny's mother, Noreen Gosch. They're with us this evening. David, 1991 comes around, and suddenly there is a new person entering this story. Talk to me about Paul Bonacci, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first, he's really the first person who comes forward to say that he was directly involved in the case. Essentially, Paul was a key witness in a teen prostitution ring that was exposed in Omaha, Nebraska in the late 80s and early 90s. And as part of his testimony to investigators about his involvement in that, he mentioned that he happened to be involved in helping to kidnap a paperboy from Des Moines, Iowa. And so that sort of news got out, and that sets up a meeting between him and Noreen for the first time. And the lucky for us, you know, for the film at least, the local news, the NBC news affiliate, went and shot that interview. And Paul was not sure of who he was meeting at the time. He thought he was sort of doing an interview and was going to talk about it. So it's pretty explosive material that's in the film that was documented when Noreen meets Paul for the first time to discuss what happened.
I'd like to ask you real quickly. All right, this guy's got his own issues. Obviously, he's a molester. He's been molested, and he suffers from multiple personality disorder. As a matter of fact, one of his personalities, if I understood it correctly, is a name he calls himself, Mark Anderson, as he tells part of the story. Is that correct?
I forgot what names he calls himself, but yeah, he was diagnosed with having multiple personality disorder, stemming from years of essentially ritual abuse from the time he was a little kid all the way through late teens. He was diagnosed with having multiple personality disorder, and it sort of was his way for coping with some of these really sort of dark things that happened to him.
Has it ever been researched? I mean, he used the name Mark Anderson in the documentary when he's talking about it, when he starts to give the information, and there were other names. Has it ever been researched? Do any of these names match up with other missing children that maybe he took on that personality or took on that aspect of one of these children that he was involved in abducting?
As far as we were able to investigate, we weren't able to make any kind of correlation there as to what the names represented. And yet, you know, you never know. But through our studies, we weren't able to make a correlation there.
We need to take a break. When we come back, Paul Bonacci, what is it like to sit down before the young man that claims to have information regarding the abduction of your son and the story that follows? We'll hear that from the only person that can truly put us in that position, Noreen Gosch, when we return to Coast AM. Tonight, the remarkable disappearance of Johnny Gosch in 1982. We are talking with his mother, Noreen Gosch, two of the documentarians involved in the film Who Took Johnny, and we've just introduced a new player into the story, Paul Bonacci. This character is now brought to your attention, Noreen. You are going to go sit face-to-face with this man that claims that he had a hand in the abduction of your son. How does somebody prepare to sit down in front of someone making that claim? I can't even begin to fathom what you must have been going through.
Well, his attorney, John DeCamp, had hired a private investigator who was working with Paul to get his whole story recorded. And he made an appointment to see me and then brought the information to me about what Paul had to say. I do have to say that it took me a month or so before I felt that I could go to the prison and sit across the table from him without showing animosity. And once I had my head around that and was able to shield myself from anything except what he had to say, then we set up the appointment to go to the prison with the warden. And I knew that if I was in Paul's presence and had feelings of anything stronger against him for being a part of this, he would pick up on it and we wouldn't hear the truth. When Paul was introduced to me and he was told I was Johnny's mom, he just broke down. He kept saying, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. They forced me." And he told us many things that day. He was very helpful. He wasn't playing any games. He didn't ask for anything in return. He served his whole sentence.
So he had nothing to gain by sharing his story. He wasn't going to get a reduced sentence. He wasn't going to get time served, nothing. This was purely a man who needed to come forward and explain what happened.
He did, and he said that he felt that in order to try to correct some of what had happened, if he truly was turning his life around, that he had to do this. He had to share what he knew to give me some peace and continue, you know, to work with his attorney. And I have to say, the young man did turn his life around. He's married now, has children, has a steady job, and, you know, his help was just so valuable to us. And yet, he got a lot of ridicule because all this hit the news big time.
Right. And now, he's making these claims, and I don't want to give too much away because I want people to still see the documentary as well. And we sound like we're covering a lot, but guys, we are still just skimming the surface of the lake of this story. And I want them to watch his documentary so they can see how much information he was able to give you. But again, here you've got somebody who has a bit of a shady background, a shady reputation. How does he start to confirm his claims to you? What is he giving you that lets you know that this isn't just some opportunist looking to cash in or maybe even torture you and make a game of it?
Well, that's where the private investigator came in that John DeCamp had hired. He had been validating everything that Paul gave them. And Paul was also gave all his testimony in court, all his depositions. And we were able, through the private investigator, to verify many of the points that Paul gave us. And one of the things was the location where Johnny was taken after they left Des Moines. And the name of the man that owned the house where they took Johnny. So based on a sketch that Paul did for us, he was quite an artist, that private investigator went to the county attorney in that area and went through all the mug books, and bingo, we found the guy. It was an exact replica of this drawing that Paul made. And the man had a record as long as your arm for sexual offenses with boys. And that is where they took Johnny for a period of about 2 weeks.
You're facing this now. If I can ask real quickly, Noreen, you're sitting in front of this man, not sure if you're about to hear that your son was murdered or what happened to him. This is the part that became inconceivable for me as a parent and an uncle and a grandfather. Suddenly you go from the idea that maybe you've come to terms with the fact that your son is now gone. He's passed on. And then you're given this, in a sense, light of hope that he still may be alive. But then you hear what he had to go through.
That was the hardest part. Hearing what he had to go through. And when I was in the room and the guards brought Paul in chains and handcuffs, I turned my head and I looked over at him and he looked at me. And at that moment, I knew I was going to hear the truth. and I fainted. The cameraman saw me start to go down, and he caught me so I didn't hit my head on the concrete wall and put me in a chair, and then I was okay after I came to, and then they brought Paul over to talk to me. But it hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm going to hear the rest of the story. And Paul was very articulate. And any time that a person would talk to him in years going forward, he never changed one word of what he said.
Now, he was also giving you some information that had been out in the news that could be very easily researched and memorized, but he would also give you details, and again, I want people to watch the documentary, so I don't want to give too much away, but he would give you details, small details. Now, this is, what, almost 9 years after Johnny went missing. How could he remember such small details that weren't part of the news? I mean, doesn't it seem strange with all the other cases he was involved in that he could still remember specifics about your son?
Johnny's case was one of the biggest ones to ever hit the news. It was a big case. And one thing about people who have multiple personality disorders, when you find the correct personality that knows the information on a certain subject,
and you're getting a little quiet on us again, Noreen.
What?
You're getting a little faded and quiet on us again. I don't know if you need to readjust the phone.
A person that has a multiple personality disorder, if you find the correct personality for a given subject, it will give you the absolute truth, change a word of that. Paul has been like that throughout the whole time I've known him. And if there was something that I would ask him and he didn't know the answer, he would look at me and he'd say, "I'm sorry, I don't know that." He wouldn't just make up words to fill space. And he was very precise. And then at a later time, the two psychiatrists that were hired by the Nebraska State Legislature to investigate and evaluate him, they both testified that he was telling the truth about the Gosch kidnapping, and that was later proved in a court of law, 1999, February. Judge Erbaum ruled that Paul was telling the truth about the Gosch kidnapping. So it's already been a part of a court record.
Well, at that time, and let me point this question to Michael, or if you need to deflect it to David, Michael, that's fine. But did the police ever question Paul Bonacci about this case? I mean, now it's he's talking to the media. He's talking to attorneys. They're making this information known. How are the police reacting to this case?
They refused to go speak to him. That was one of the most baffling things that we dealt with. And they're the thing they say in the film back at the time was that he wasn't credible, and they'd been told he wasn't credible, so they didn't want to talk to him. And that was just, it just still doesn't make any sense, because they didn't have to act on anything he said, but to refuse to even hear what he had to say was just unbelievable.
David, what were they using as the basis of dismissing the credibility of this man who could tell specifics about this case and knew way too much for somebody that would have been making the story up?
Well, the local West Des Moines police said that the FBI considered him an uncredible witness as it related to Paul's testimony with the sort of Franklin scandal, which is what they called the prostitution network that was exposed in Omaha. So his involvement with that and his testimony there was deemed uncredible by the FBI and law enforcement and Omaha law enforcement. And so West Des Moines police said basically, "Oh, well, we've heard he's uncredible, so we're not going to interview him." And as Mike said, you know, they didn't have to act on it, and certainly they followed up a lot of dead-end leads throughout their investigation. So it seemed a little bit mind-boggling that the only person who ever came forward to say that they were directly involved in this would not be interviewed.
Now, they didn't interview him, but they did speak to his siblings, right? Yes. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's you know, the case files are so old that the West Des Moines police, you know, they couldn't quite give us the exact information, but basically they said that they had spoken to his siblings who put him in Omaha at the time of Johnny's disappearance. So a couple of things about that. One is Paul was sort of estranged from his siblings. Secondly, Omaha is about 2-hour drive from Des Moines. So it's not inconceivable that he could have, you know, helped participate in Johnny's abduction and then got back to Omaha the next day. They're not that far apart.
And this question was being asked years later, at least a year later, or many years later. So the idea that his siblings would remember from 5, 10, 15 years earlier what had happened is ridiculous.
Right. The siblings had been interviewed in the 90s, but this was something that had happened 9 years earlier, 1991, but this was something that happened 9 years earlier. So they had to say 9 years later, oh, yeah, that morning he was in Omaha. But, you know, as Mike just said, certainly it's hard to remember then, and Omaha's not very far from Des Moines.
We only have about 3 minutes left in this segment, Noreen. It wasn't just one man. It wasn't just Paul Bonacci. There were letters from other kids and other people involved in this ring. Did they mention Johnny Gosch specifically?
Yes, a number of the letters did, and then I have copies of several of Paul's diaries. And it outlines the kidnapping of Johnny. In there, detailed other people that knew of it, what their plan was, where they took him, and his attorney made those copies available to me.
And you're reading these things. I can't even understand how to process that as the mother of a child. And you start reading the accounts and the stories of what's going on. You find out that your son wasn't just abducted, but was used in sexual ways and sold and traded.
And Paul Bonacci was a witness
right.
to the man who bought Johnny laying down the money and paying the kidnapper. And when you sell another person, that's human trafficking.
Out of curiosity, were there ever any kidnap notes or calls made to you?
We had one ransom demand, and the FBI and the local police refused to work it the night that it came. So my private investigator and I went over to where the note was left, because there was a phone call that came into our home, and we drove over ourselves and got it. That should have been a policeman in that car, not a mom.
And
it was in the middle of the night.
Where you get this message and they're putting out a demand, did you ever decide to try to make a payment on it, or were you threatened for trying to think about doing that?
They were asking for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I need to have proof of life. And they hung up on me. But we decided to take the car and go to the location where they said the note was left, just to see if there was a note. And sure enough, there was a note left. It was on a phone booth, something you don't see around town anymore.
Right.
Phone booths are gone. But they had left a note in a phone booth. And when I asked for proof of life, they hung up.
And in a quick answer, did you receive threats after he went missing to leave this case alone? And I don't mean from the police or the FBI. Did you ever receive any anonymous threats to back off?
I received quite a number of death threats telling me to leave the case alone, drop it, or I would die.
All right. We're coming to the top of the hour. We will continue this twisted journey. America's Most Wanted gets involved. Here you've got one of the biggest advocates on the planet, John Walsh, involved in this case, taking another fresh look at this in 1992. This surely is going to turn things around and expose what's going on. How does law enforcement take this, and how do they jump into the fray? You have to stay tuned to find out. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.